Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Going the extra mile to help right social justice wrongs in Ferguson. A little later in the program, we'll meet a man who's swimming that extra distance. But first, journalist, commentator, and public policy analyst Goldie Taylor. She also has social justice issues very much on her mind. She's familiar to most of us for her work on cable news programs. She's also senior editor for BNR, Blue Nation Review, a website devoted to progressive political commentary. Goldie Taylor is a local product, born in University City and grew up in East St. Louis. She is coming home, if you will, next week to participate in a Junior Chamber International Symposium on Social Equality. She joins us now by phone from Alexandria, Virginia. Goldie, so nice to talk to you.
It's good to be here, Don. It's good to be with you.
A bit of a homecoming for you next week.
It absolutely is, and I have to tell you how honored I am to have been invited by the group that we know as the JCs in St. Louis. They were launched in St. Louis nearly 100 years ago. This is their 100th birthday, and so it is an honor to have been invited by them to participate in what I believe is a critical conversation to our community.
Yes, we've had many conversations about the issues you'll be talking about, with many more to come. As I said to you off the air, the next step, I think, is to translate some of these conversations into some sort of positive action.
That will be interesting. You know, the conversation has been over these recent months since August of 2014, the incident out on Canfield Drive between Michael Brown and former Ferguson officer Darren Wilson have ignited, I think, a significant conversation, a difficult and challenging one, of course, but one that I hope will result in some meaningful change that impacts all of St. Louis. Greater St. Louis certainly deserves to have policing and responsive communities. I think this is a balanced conversation to be had in order to raise the quality of life, I think, for everyone.
Given the things that have happened following Ferguson, and there have been any number of incidents, as you well know, how would you view the state of race relations in this country today, at this moment?
At this very moment, they are worrisome, troublesome to me. But they're not unlike they had been, you know, over the course of my life. I turned 47 this next weekend. I'm quite shocked that I've made it quite this far. But over the course of my life, I don't know that they have been better, although we are more vocal today about our differences, more vocal about our ideologies, whatever they are, from one end of the spectrum to the other. And so while some of these conversations may have been dinner table conversations, they're now out in the open, out in the street. And so our dirty laundry, as it were, is now out for everyone to see and out for everyone to have to reckon with.
But there have been so many things that have happened since Ferguson. I think the Eric Garner case in Staten Island was just before Ferguson. But we've had Baltimore, and we've had incidents in Cleveland, and we've had other incidents in this area. They just keep happening.
You know, in terms of the more high profile shootings involving unarmed black boys and men, you know, they aren't more frequent today than they ever have been. They've always occurred. It's only now, with the advent of social media, with 24/7 news cycles, that the broader community is allowed to see and inspect them, to hear the 911 tapes, to see the third-party citizen video that goes up live-streamed over Twitter. And so it's now out where all of us have to reckon with it. All of us have to sort of assess it, you know, based on our own socialization. And so it's not that they are more frequent. It is that they are more visible, really, to us, and that we really have to do something or say something about them. I think that increased opportunity for conversation, whether it be via social media or our cable news networks or even here on NPR, that increased ability to have open conversation certainly sometimes increased the furor over some of these events. And so it's not that these things are more frequent. They've been happening throughout my lifetime and certainly throughout yours. It is just today that we are, you know, just more readily able to see them almost in real time.
And because we are seeing them, it seems to me, and perhaps to you, that there is a sustained energy out there, particularly amongst young people, to keep these conversations and ultimately some sort of action going.
Sure. You know, I had wondered when, you know, when we take a look at some of the patterns of policing throughout St. Louis County that have emerged. I think the Washington Post did an in-depth study around this, and certainly the Guardian newspaper did some great work around this in terms of detailing what came out in the Department of Justice report under former Attorney General Eric Holder, mm-hmm. in terms of detailing some of those disparities in policing and some of those pay-for-play courts that exist in those very small jurisdictions, well, small and large, around St. Louis County. These were things that we all grew up with, that we sort of understood were the order of the day. They were the realities of being Black and living in St. Louis. And in and around the St. Louis area, even in the East Metro. But to see those kinds of reports come out and to see that there was going to truly be a community response to those kinds of things, I just wondered when it would happen. I was not always sure that this conversation was going to be had, that status quo was ever really going to be broken. To see that the voices, the strongest voices in this, have come from our young people, is gratifying to me, frankly. This is the generation that will carry, you know, the baton forward for us. They are the generation who will, I think, continue to hold these conversations and press for change when many of us in older generations, frankly, were not able to or were not willing to. And so I am, while the unrest is unfortunate and heartbreaking, the loss of property, the loss of human life is unfortunate to me and heartbreaking to me. I think that if there is any good at all to come out of it, is that we are having a real conversation about policing in St. Louis, that we are having real conversations about what I have called an American apartheid that exists really throughout the area in terms of segregated housing, a broken criminal justice system, reforms that are necessary to school districts around the area. And so when we look at all of those pathologies, the broken social institutions, to know that we're really going to have a meaningful discussion and seek meaningful change around those issues, I think is gratifying to me. The unfortunate part is it took a community to stand up, both and certainly, you know, watching peaceful protesters march through the street, you know, and I joined them very early on, was something that I think was necessary. But the boiling point, the overboiling, the violence that ensued thereafter, I don't think any of us can condone. I don't think any of us can say was the right thing to do, even though we, you know, understand the social fabric that may have produced it.
Let me put this on a personal note for you, if I may, or ask on a personal note. The fact that it did happen here and the fact that you thought it was going to happen at some point somewhere, what were your thoughts from afar as you looked at what was happening in Ferguson?
Well, I wondered if, you know, at that time I was working with MSNBC as a political contributor, and I wondered if national media would get the story right. I wondered if they understood the fabric, the framework at work in St. Louis and in other big cities, just like that around the country, in Baltimore and Cleveland and Los Angeles and Oakland. I wondered if they really understood the story that was unfolding. But even more than that, I wondered if local media understood what was happening around them. I wondered why they had not done significant reporting around the thing prior to these events. And so watching from afar, I was both watching the people on the ground, but also watching how it was covered both locally and nationally, and which voices, you know, emerged at the top of the heap.
And what conclusions did you come to?
The conclusion that I came to is that they really didn't understand what was unfolding before them. Is that, you know, if you look historically, when people talk about the civil rights movement, for instance, they think about a time between, you know, the mid-1940s to the late 1960s in this country, you know, as an isolated era in this country, when in fact, you know, civil rights as a movement began just after emancipation. The fight began for equal protection. The fight began for voting rights. The fight began for property rights, the right to marry, the right to a free and public education. Those things really ignited then. In a first wave, the second wave we saw in the mid-40s to the late 1960s. But now we're standing in the midst of a third wave. And I don't know that local or national media really sort of picked up on that. I think they believed that there would be one or two nights of protest, and then this would all be over. And then you turn around, and in cities across the country, D.C., Los Angeles, New York, there are thousands of people of every walk of life, diverse in their faith and in their economic background, come together in throngs, march through the streets in protest. You heard them say Black Lives Matter. People who weren't always black, you heard them really point to the systemic injustices, as they sort of marched through the streets. And so I do think that this is a sustainable movement. I do think that we are in a third wave of civil rights and that we're going to see changes on a number of fronts, both to how, we continue to segregate ourselves as a people, both in public policy and in public practice, and that you may see some changes in policing, both at the federal and local level, that are more focused on, rehabilitation, that they're more focused on investment and community partnering, and that they're sort of less focused on what we call this hotspot policing that really only serves to target certain demographics over others.
We're talking with Goldie Taylor, journalist, commentator. She's going to be here next week for a social equality symposium. The Junior Chamber International presents that symposium on social equality on Thursday the 23rd from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at UMSL's Two Hill Performing Arts Center. Goldie Taylor will be here for that. She's serving as MC for that event, that day-long event. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay with us. If you'd like to become a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. Back with Goldie Taylor in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Now back to Goldie Taylor. Goldie, given some of the things that have happened most recently, long after Ferguson, I'd like to get your take on how these incidents and situations add to the conversation we've been talking about, the burning of black churches in the South, and also the rebel flag discussion and the subsequent removal of the rebel flag in South Carolina. Your take on that and how that keeps the conversation going.
I think, some of us, I lived in Atlanta, at the time as an early Buck reporter, but before even that, I had been a student activist, and around 1992, 1993, we started the fight against the Confederate flag flying over the Georgia State House. And that fight took us to South Carolina and to other places around the South. We were successful nearly two decades and several governors later in pulling down the Georgia flag. But in South Carolina, they had reached a compromise to leave it standing on their state house grounds and not flying atop its dome. For so many Americans, it is a flag of heritage. But when you look into what that heritage is, when you look into the racial animus, the history of slavery behind it, why those flags were raised again in protest of sweeping civil rights gains, in the middle of the century, in the 50s and 60s. South Carolina itself raised its flag again in 1961 in direct response, ironically, to something called the Friendship Nine. Eight students and a professor who sat at a lunch counter in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and refused to move. They were arrested and then refused to post even their own bail. They decided to stay in jail. And so some 50 years later, the flag was taken down after the Emanuel Nine, in Charleston, Charleston, South Carolina, where they were massacred in a church that had been burned some 140 years prior. And so all of the history sort of came together in a single moment, and it took all of that to bring that flag down. But people shouldn't be mistaken. this is, fight is not just about a Confederate battle emblem, a rebel flag. It is about what it embodies and represents, not just to African Americans, but for all Americans, that we would decide to celebrate and honor a legacy of slavery, a legacy of segregation, a legacy of Jim Crow, the very same emblem that is or was hoisted above the heads of Klansmen as they burned out black churches and homes, throughout the second wave of the civil rights movement. And so to see it taken down was gratifying for so many of us who had fought for a very long time, but it still waves in Mississippi and in other places. For me, what someone chooses to do on their own is freedom of speech. But when we decide to subsidize it using public dollars, I think is another discussion altogether. And so I am pleased that it happened. What I'm not so pleased about is that we continue to see violence in our community, and I call them acts of terrorism when a black church is burned, when nine church members are murdered in their church basement after a prayer service by a perfect stranger. I call those acts of terrorism meant to instill fear. We don't know for certain the cause of all seven or eight fires that have erupted over the last 2 weeks in cities largely across the South. One of them, I believe, was in Ohio. I think some of them were due to natural causes and maybe electrical issues because, churches do burn. But to have this concentration happen so closely together was certainly suspicious for many, including myself. And whether or not they were intentional arsons by someone from outside the community or some other natural cause, I believe every community deserves to know. For black churches specifically, they are such a critical part of the community fabric. And that's why Dylan Roof took on Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, because he knew the critical and historic importance of that structure of the people who worship there. And so when the FBI calls black churches soft targets, people understand that the people there are going to be welcoming, that strangers are welcome with open arms, and that people likely won't be armed during services. And so it's a cowardly act. But whether or not, again, I say if these were accidental or whether they were set intentionally, I think as an American public, we deserve to know. And if they were intentional, we deserve to have a rigorous investigation and that the perpetrator be found in jail.
Turning back to the Confederate memorabilia, if you will, or memorials, how far do you think we should go in dealing with that? There are some people who have suggested, for instance, that the Jefferson Memorial in Washington is something we should take a look at because he owned slaves. There are some monuments and parks, including St. Louis, which are dedicated to the war dead in the of the Confederacy. Right. And people are saying, get rid of it. How far should we go in this area?
I don't believe in the eraser of history. I live in Alexandria, Virginia, which is a colonial town, and I am surrounded by memorials and markers that talk about the history of this town, both as a slave trading post and at home to people who fought on the side of the Confederacy. I am not bothered by having myself and school children and broader community learning about our history and being able to see, emblems of that history in historic places. What does concern me, however, is the way in which these Confederate flags were raised above state houses in direct defiance to civil rights, to direct defiance to the sweeping civil rights gains that were happening across the country as Jim Crow began to fall, as Brown versus the Board of Education was ruled in 1956, Georgia changed its flag in defiance of that. And so I am absolutely appalled when we take these symbols and use them not for the greater good, but for the condemnation of human rights. And so I think, and therein lies the difference for me. But I absolutely do, want to see these memorials. I think if we began taking a look at memorials across Washington, we'd have to take a scraper and take them all down. because we do have a very complicated, a very complex history. But we should deal with all of it on its face, that we should deal with it honestly, that when people talk about the Civil War and say, gosh, it was about states' rights and about nullification. We shouldn't leave out that the question of nullification centered around the ability to keep slaves, to own human chattel. And those years of absolute terror, slavery was no fairy tale. People died, people bled, people were raped, people were separated from their families. That kind of human atrocity should not be swept under the rug. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, really the center of it for me. It is disheartening when I see other activists talking about taking down or removing street names of everything that harkens back to the Confederacy. It is a part, really, of our history. I just want to make certain that we're not celebrating the top, you know, state house capitals as if, you know, we want segregation and we want economic disparities to continue. And that's really what raising them was about.
There's more to talk about that, but I want to bring in a listener who has been waiting to talk to Goldie Taylor. That would be Elaine calling from the Shaw neighborhood. Elaine, thank you for waiting. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. I have been part of a interracial discussion group since Ferguson, or really since after Von Derrick was murdered and or shot. And we have some issues that are sticking points, and I would like a little bit of clarification from you, Ms. Waters, if possible. One of them is the saying we want acknowledgement from our black friends, saying we want acknowledgement. I'd like to know what that looks like. And the second is that we have differing views as far as how to look at Ferguson, at the aftermath of Ferguson. Some of it see it as steps forward, as literally making good out of evil. And others of us just tend to brush it aside and dismiss it as not being irrelevant to the larger cause. And the third issue that gives us problems over and over again is the issue of personal responsibility and how we choose to voice our narrative, how we choose to remember our history.
Sure.
Elaine, thank you.
From a positive side or a negative side.
Elaine, thank you for the call. I'll just remind you, I think you misspoke a moment ago when you referred to Ms. Waters. Well, we're talking with Goldie Taylor, of course, and she's in Alexandria right now. So, Goldie, go ahead. Would you like to respond to Elaine?
Oh, absolutely. And I find Elaine's questions to be absolutely thoughtful. I'll take the last one first in terms of personal responsibility. You know, I am one of those people, and I've, as a single parent, raised my children on that theme, that you are personally accountable for your actions, that you are to lead orderly, lawful lives, that you are to educate yourselves, and that if there is an opportunity available to you, it is up to you to work hard for it and to seize it and embrace it. And so I agree in large part to the notion of personal responsibility, but there is also something of a community responsibility and what responsibility we have to the individuals to making certain that this American dream is available equally to everyone, not simply available, but equally available to everyone, that a black child raised in East St. Louis should not have to work three times as hard as a white child growing up in Chesterfield, Missouri, to reach the same goal, and that we ought to begin to lend some credence to that disparity, and that, you know, that a part of this means that we've got to reckon with our own culpability in these disparities. I remember growing up when my brothers would apply for jobs as young black boys coming out of East St. Louis, and restaurants they'd apply to be a busboy, say, in a downtown restaurant in St. Louis. And the moment that someone saw East St. Louis on their job application, it was discarded. And so that kind of economic disparity, economic separation, I think, is a large, large part of this. Until we began to look at the roots of these issues, until we began to look at things like environmental justice, until we began to look at things like, you know, the disparities in public education, until we began to look at what happens in the justice system and that how much justice you have access to has more to do with who you are and how much money you have in your pocket than it does to do with the crime or, you know, your level of criminality. You know, when you look at all of these things across the board and more, a new picture begins to emerge that says, but for the grace of God, there go I. I could have as easily been born a black child in East St. Louis as I could a white child in St. Anne or, you know, or in Winsfield. But depending on who I am and where I was born and under what circumstance, you know, really has a lot to do with what my personal success is going to look like, what roadblocks may stand in my way. And it's our job to begin to blow up those roadblocks that stand in the way of our young people, in the way of our children. And so, but whatever opportunity is available to you, I think you have the responsibility to put your arms around that with your whole heart. And so I think that while Elaine posits a great point about personal responsibility, I think there's a larger responsibility that we as a greater community have in terms of how we help to rebuild, reform the very social institutions that our public policy so intentionally broke. And so I think that's a large part of it. And that leads us right into Ferguson, that leads us right into Baltimore, that leads us right into Oakland and other places where we've seen uprisings, that leads us right into implicit bias and how a 12-year-old child playing with a toy gun in a snowy park in Cleveland could be shot dead by police within seconds of encountering him. That means that my young black boy cannot play with a toy gun that's sold at every Walmart or every Kmart store, every Target store. That toy isn't accessible to my child, but may be accessible. This is a multi-layered issue, I think, that being part of a multiracial conversation group is an important, critical thing. I wish that more of that would happen in more places around this country, because I think that's where the real solutions lie, not necessarily just in Washington.
Time is getting away, but I do want to get one more call in. Mike's been waiting. He's calling from the Hill neighborhood. Mike, go ahead, but make it fast, please.
Hi, Goldie. You made a lot of great points, and we all need to discuss these things. And what I see on TV now are these commercials for stopping violence, and I see them, and I part of me enjoy it, or you know, I embrace it. But how can the black community defend itself against this war on drugs? Every night you see a black person being shot or shooting another black person. And right. It's the tension in our society that's created by this perversion that we think we can prevent people from taking drugs. And that's fighting the very freedom that our culture stands for. And it's really a racial bias that we continue to think that we can, that our Johnny in West County can have the pot party, but the little black boy who has to run the drugs in the city cannot do that and is put upon by the violence. It just makes me angry.
You know, you're absolutely right about that. I think that, you know, the context of this is my father and brothers were murdered in St. Louis. My father in 1973, another brother in 1990. Another brother was killed in Wichita, Kansas in 1991. All of them were killed by other black men. And so the issue of black-on-black crime, as it were, is a critical one to me. But I think a default conversation that moves us away from, you know, some of those root issues that we've talked about earlier in this conversation, it's a way out of culpability for so many of us. If they don't care about their own lives, then why should we care about them? Then why should policing be any different? You raise a critical point when you talk about the disparities in policing in terms of drug. While drug usage, especially marijuana, is about equal among blacks and whites, if you are black, you are six times more likely to be arrested in jail for possession. And so that speaks to how we use, you know, targeted policing. So if you're smoking marijuana in a dorm room at, you know, Washington University, you are less likely to be arrested in jail for that. Certainly not jailed for it, than if you are standing on a street corner in East St. Louis selling drugs to a car that comes across the bridge from St. Louis, just less likely. That's a disparity, you know, that we can point out as an instance in time, but there are so many more that mimic it. But when you use this war on drugs, as you called it, as I call it, to crack down on communities like this, it isn't just the individual life that you take away. Take away fathers. You break up churches. You break up local institutions that are so meaningful. The New York Times did a study recently that showed more than 2.5 million black men are missing from American life. They're either in jail or they have, they're dead in a premature way, that they are frankly disappeared from black life. But then the news reports will tell you that black lives and that black fathers are not involved in their children's lives. And so you can't have one half of the conversation without having the other. You can't point to the symptom, you know, of the cancer and not point to the source of the ill. And so I think until we began to have a holistic conversation about how some of our policies, including what we call the war on drugs, I think there's a documentary called The House I Live In that I encourage everybody to see that talks about how this intentionally good, you know, federalized program, including three strikes, you're out, intended to be good, but at the end of the day, wound up overcriminalizing black and brown people and breaking down social institutions that once held communities together.
Goldie Taylor, is so much to talk about and so little time, as they say. We're going to have to end it there. I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to welcoming you next Thursday, the 23rd, for that day-long symposium, the JCI Symposium on Social Equality at the UMSL Two Hill Performing Arts Center. Thank you so much for being with us, and safe trip to St. Louis.
Thank you, Don.
Thanks. Coming up, getting into the swim of things for Ferguson kids. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.